Sunstone Symposium. This session is being sponsored by Dialogue, a Journal of Mormon Thought. We still have seats up front for those of you that can't find them. This morning, the topic of our panel discussion is the BYU dilemma: do real universities limit academic freedom? We didn't imply an answer in the question, but it's one of those questions that implies many answers. Just by show of hands and out of curiosity, how many people in the audience have attended BYU as a student or have taught at BYU or have been related in one of those ways to BYU? Wow. And you're willing to admit it freely. That's good. My name is Alan Roberts. I'll be the moderator for this session. My background is I'm a graduate of BYU. I will admit it. I am an architect, one of the new co-editors of Dialogue, and formerly connected with Sunstone as well. We have four panelists with us this morning, and they'll be speaking to you for 10 minutes each, after which we'll direct some questions to the panel from me as moderator, and at the end we'll try to provide enough time in this hour and a half session to have questions from the audience. The first speaker will be Fred Buchanan. Fred is a professor of educational history in the Educational Studies Department at the University of Utah. He's had that position since 1970. He's received two awards from the Mormon History Association for Best Book and Best Article. The current project of his is a centennial history of the Salt Lake School District from 1890 to 1990. So Fred brings to us a wealth of background and information about the history of education in the state. He'll be followed by L. Jackson Newell, professor, higher education, University of Utah, a former co-editor of Dialogue, former dean of the Liberal Arts College, editor, writer. Following Jack, we will hear from David Knowlton, assistant professor of anthropology at BYU. He received his bachelor's from the University of Utah, master's from the University of Texas at Austin, and a PhD from that same institution. David has been lecturing frequently of late on a variety of subjects and represents the only person from BYU that was willing to participate that we asked. We asked several persons, including those involved in the statement and others indirectly involved, and these others declined to participate. Finally, we will hear from Armin Moss. Armin has been a long-time supporter and board member of Dialogue. I think he said this morning he's been involved for 15 years. Armin published, through Dialogue, two very important issues, articles on the issue of blacks in the priesthood. He has been currently editor of Journal of the Scientific Study of Religion. So we welcome these panelists. We'll hear from them in that order. I would like to say as a preface that the general topic of discussion will be the draft statement on academic freedom being circulated currently to the faculty at BYU. It's being circulated for comment and review. It will be returned, revised, and it will come out in some form that is undetermined right now. Accompanying that statement will be another companion document on the enforcement policy regarding the statement. And I think this should enter into our discussion as well. So with that very brief introduction, I'd like to now turn the podium over to Fred Buchanan.
I had four or five different ways to approach this topic this morning, from an historical perspective, from a learning theory perspective, from a sort of pragmatic, anecdotal perspective. This morning I got up and scrapped everything and started over again. I'd like to begin by reading two little statements which sort of might set the problem that I, as I see it. One, a statement of Samuel Johnson, whom as a Scot I don't have much respect for, but he was a pretty good English writer. He said, "Every man has the right to utter what he thinks truth, and every other man has a right to knock him down for it." And then a statement that when I attended BYU summer session of 1963, a couple of workshops I attended, I remember reading in one of the newspapers a statement of a BYU professor of child development. "If a teacher knows what the truth is, there is absolutely nothing wrong with indoctrination." So that sort of frames the issue. And as I left, my son, well, I've got some conflicting loyalties here because my second son has just become engaged to a wonderful young woman from BYU. So he said, "Dad, be positive, will you?" When Dwight Eisenhower became president of Columbia University after he had commanded the United Nations Armed Forces in Europe, he was sitting in the faculty meeting telling the faculty what the university would be doing under his leadership. And he kept saying, "The university will do this, the university won't do that, the university will be this, will be that, the next thing." Finally, a faculty member stood up and said, "Mr. President, we are the university." A university is not made of sticks and stones. It's not made of buildings or campuses. It's an idea. And it's, in essence, a university is a faith commitment that maximum freedom of expression will mean maximum benefits to all, to the faculty, to the students, and to the community. Now, you can't prove that. That's why I'm saying it's a faith statement, that it's held to tenaciously as a faith statement. But it's not accepted by everyone. The history of academic freedom is the history of attacks on it and efforts to defend it. And it seems to me that the conflict is essentially between two tendencies. One, the tendency to hold the old adage that he who pays the piper calls the tune. That is what ought to determine what happens at a university. And the other is something I was trying to get this morning. I couldn't find Bill Mulder to get the exact quotation, but I remember it from an English class that I had from him, in which Henry David Thoreau talks about if people are not exactly in step with everyone else, perhaps it's because they're listening to the beat of a different drummer. So we have a sort of piper and drum mixture here. And pipes are necessary to give a little life to the thing, and drums are necessary for a steady beat. Both are probably necessary as far as running an institution is concerned. But seriously, the need for control, the cultural need for control, seems to be at the root of much of the problem of academic freedom. And let me read you a rather radical statement from Jules Henry in his book Culture Against Man, in which he says, "The function of education has never been to free the mind and spirit of man, but to bind them. And to that end, the mind and spirit of his children should never escape. And to that end, that the mind and spirit of his children should never escape, Homo sapiens has employed praise, ridicule, admonition, accusation, mutilation, and even torture to chain them to the cultural pattern. Throughout most of his historic course, Homo sapiens has wanted from his children acquiescence, not originality. It is natural that this should be so, for where every man is unique, there is no society, and where there is no society, there can be no man or woman. Contemporary American educators think they want creative children, yet it is an open question as to what they expect these children to create. And certainly the classrooms, from kindergarten to graduate school, in which they expect it to happen, are not crucibles of creative activity and thought. It stands to reason that where young people truly creative, the culture would fall apart. Well, the whole point is that, look, control is a necessary part of having a culture. And that is certainly part of he who pays the piper calls the tune syndrome. At the other end of it, we could find some solace in Thomas Jefferson. I mean, academic freedom is in large measure a reflection and an extension of civil liberties. And Jefferson said, "Truth is great and will prevail if left to herself. She is the proper and sufficient antagonist to error and has nothing to fear from the conflict unless by human interpositions disarmed her of her natural weapons, free argument and debate. Error ceasing to be dangerous when it is permitted freely to contradict them." And we all take great comfort in that, and certainly we would quote it if we were ever challenged. However, Thomas Jefferson, not too many years after this, in giving advice to someone who had written to him about what shall we do with the Tory David Hume's History of England in America, he said, "In discussing the use of David Hume's history in the teaching of American students and to prevent students from sliding into Federalist doctrine, Jefferson approved the policy of the editor who gives you the text of Hume purely and verbally till he comes to some misrepresentation or omission. He then alters the text silently, makes it say what truth and candor say it should, and resumes the original text again as soon as it becomes innocent without having warned you of your rescue from misguidance." This is the guy who swore eternal vigilance on the altar of Almighty God against all forms of tyranny over the human mind. Well, he could waffle on that. He could waffle on that. The point is, and the interesting thing is that David Hume couldn't get an appointment at the University of Edinburgh or the University of Glasgow because he wasn't orthodox enough. In America, he was too orthodox. So it depends on where you're, the lay of the land and where you're viewing it from. At the same time, although Glasgow University refused David Hume an appointment, it appointed Adam Smith, who produced Wealth of Nations. So it's a mixed bag. I've heard that Fawn Brody at the University of California had real troubles getting either promoted or tenured because of the particular tack she took in history, the psychological history, the interpretation of history. I've also heard, and I can't document these, but I've heard it, probably at Sunstone. I've heard that Henry Eyring was up for consideration for the Nobel Prize and was refused it and was cut out of it, mainly because he was a Mormon. Well, that's a sort of infringement in academic freedom, it seems to me. And there are people at the University of Utah who have told me that in the past, the people have been denied appointments there. Why? Because they were Mormons. Not because they weren't incompetent, but because they were Mormons. So, restrictions on academic freedom are reflections of a human dilemma. A tension between fear of chaos and fear of control. Fear of chaos on the part of institutions and fear of control on the part of individuals. Now, I haven't done a lot of research on this, but I did speak to some people at BYU, and one of them said to me, "It's Bonkersville down here sometimes. Because there's too much sweetness and light. And there's not enough open debate on controversial issues. People seem to be afraid of it." Another person said that BYU reflects the rural parochial values of southern Utah. Maybe that's saying too much there. And another one said that the drive for unity in the Mormons and the problem is to mitigate against as much openness as there should be. On the other side, one person told me that a major U.S. Company had put pressure on the administration at BYU to censor a faculty for his criticism of the company, and the administration said, "Bug off." Well, they probably wouldn't say that, but they said, "Look, we're not in that business of censoring our faculty." Another occasion, the governor was upset because one faculty member had been criticizing the state's economic policies. And he tried to bring pressure on the administration to censor him, and they refused. These are areas in which there's academic freedom is shining, apparently. One anecdote that I was told concerned an old crusty old sociologist who was threatening the testimonies of the young people at BYU. And his uncle, apparently, was Joseph Fielding Smith. And parents complained to President Smith about this, or he found out about it. Complained too when I made a statement in a fireside once, 1954, that there were more people excommunicated in Scotland than converted in the 1850s. I was taking that from the Millennial Star, and I was almost prevented from doing any more research at the Church Historian's Office because of that. But anyway, Joseph Fielding Smith wrote a letter to this sociologist's nephew and complained about his threatening the, and driving away the people from the church. And his nephew wrote a letter back which said, "Dear Uncle Joseph, in essence, I am in receipt of your complaint about my teaching, and I acknowledge that I do ask students questions, but I'd be glad to put my list of people driven away from the church against yours any day." And he kept teaching at BYU. Now, there is a genuine... John Dewey... How's the time? 2 minutes. John Dewey said... "Let us admit the case of the conservative, I can't pronounce the word, excuse me. Let us admit the case of the conservative. If we once start thinking, no one can guarantee where we shall come out, except that many objects, ends, and institutions are doomed. Every thinker puts some portion of an apparently stable world in peril, and no one can wholly predict what will emerge in its place." Now, Leonard Arrington has referred to this necessary tension as creative tension. A wonderful term, and I would hope that that's the case. Because there is genuine risk involved in exposing young Mormon minds to secular learning, and Dewey recognized it. But it seems to me that there's a Mormon scripture which says something like, "For it must needs be that there be risks in all things." And that's a necessary part of growing, of learning. I think even the educational theorists at BYU would recognize that. They know Kohlberg, they know Dewey, they know Piaget, and all of these people... And who's the other fellow? Newell, Jackson Newell. And they all base their work on the premise that unless there is tension felt, there is no learning. Dewey said it best. Unless there's a puzzle to be solved, there won't be any learning. And the puzzle causes friction, and that's necessary. Father Christensen said, "God himself is limited when men cease to think." I have too many friends at BYU who do wonderful work, and whose work is not uncontroversial. Jim Allen, Tom Alexander, among others, who have stimulated my thinking, and I appreciate what they've done, and they've done it apparently in a climate of relative academic freedom. But there's always the threat. Their persistence should give us hope that with every flow of academic freedom at the Y, a residue of the precious material will accumulate to the faculty, and that this statement will strengthen academic freedom at the Y. A faculty that has shown great resilience over the years and has demonstrated repeatedly the ability of the human spirit to prevail. To them and others who keep the flame of academic freedom alive, and it's not across the board, and it's not across the board everywhere, but who keep it alive somewhere that it might spread, I would offer the toast of Robert Burns, who in 1792 was upset by the fact that the British government was trying to censor the Edinburgh Gazetteer, which he read, and he said, "Here's freedom to them that would read. Here's freedom to them that would write. There's nane ever feared that the truth should be heard, but they whom the truth would indict."
Thank you, Fred. You've certainly inspired me, if none others, and I think I'm not alone. But perhaps you're a little too balanced, Fred. What I thought I'd do is talk a little bit about the origins of academic freedom in universities generally as a context for our conversation about the BYU statement and the BYU controversy. Universities and the Christian Church are the two, by far, most enduring institutions in Western civilization. And universities trace their origins back now about 800 years, having sprung up in Spain, in France, in Holland, and in Italy, and England, all relatively at the same time, in the 12th, 13th centuries. Most of them had their origins in the cathedral schools of the Catholic Church, where the clergy were prepared, or where you studied for the priesthood in the Catholic Church. And gradually the notion, influenced incidentally by the Crusades and the bringing back of classical works from Alexandria and other archives in the East, inspired scholars in Europe, and they began to go back to the rationalism of the Greeks and Romans, and this led to controversies between religious doctrine and the search for truth through rational means. So what happened in the origin of most of these early universities, take Padua or the University of Paris, for example, was that the cathedral schools' faculties gradually became more and more concerned about having the freedom to be able to teach what their conscience dictated should be taught, and this naturally put them in conflict with the Catholic Church. The landmark transition at the University of Paris about 1235 was where the faculty and its contention with the church finally won the right through a papal bull to control the curriculum and to decide what ought to be taught at what became the University of Paris. All our great universities, by the way, had extremely humble beginnings, and this was true in this case as well. But in each case that we trace these great European universities back to their origins, the controversy was between the original control by the church and the increasing demands for freedom by scholars to be able to study, engage students in the treatment of ideas, and together the exploration of the world in ways that their curiosity would take them rather than within the bounds of the church. Now I'm going to take a few great leaps. The Germans made a considerable contribution to academic freedom in the 17th and 18th centuries, 19th century, by making the distinction that academic freedom was not simply a right which faculty would claim, but it's equally important to students. That is, a scholar needs to have the freedom to be able to pursue research and knowledge and ideas where they take him or her. Likewise, students should have the freedom to be able to explore as their curiosity will dictate and go in the directions they wish and to be able to express their views as they feel appropriate. That is, faculty should not be in the business of intimidating students from their freedom in this ethic of exploration which universities are all about. The case of E.A. Ross and the birth of the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, in this country and in this century is perhaps most instructive for our conversation today. Stanford University is 101 years old at this point, and when it was in its very infancy, only 2 or 3 years going, Edward A. Ross, a sociologist, took a position on the faculty there, and he was interested in labor practices and labor economics. As you may know, Leland Stanford was the builder of the Central Pacific Railroad, which connected right north of us here at Promontory Summit, and he made his fortune from that railroad, and he used that fortune in part to endow Stanford University. He had died by 1900, but his widow, Mrs. Leland Stanford, served on the Board of Trustees, and she got wind of the fact that Edward Ross was interested in the labor practices of her husband. That is, how did the Central Pacific treat Chinese laborers who came across the Pacific and worked in the building of that railroad? And he found there, as we found in many other places in these kinds of studies, that the practices were, in fact, bestial in some ways, horrible conditions under which these workers labored, and terrible pay that they received. And he published the results of his research. Leland Stanford's widow demanded other members of the Board of Trustees give Edward Ross his walking papers, saying, as Fred was saying just a few moments ago, he who pays the piper calls the tune. And she said, how could you be so ungrateful as to investigate the labor practices of my husband and publish unflattering things about them when, in fact, it's his fortune and it's given you the job and pays your check? The trustees went along with this, and E.A. Ross lost his position there, and he went on to a very distinguished career at a couple of other American universities. And last night, as a matter of curiosity, I looked up his name in the Encyclopedia Britannica, and he achieved that degree of stature as a pioneering sociologist. No mention, by the way, in that article about his role in this academic freedom controversy. It was only a few years after that that these kinds of controversies were cropping up at a number of other universities, and our friend John Dewey and a variety of others got together and said, we need to form some alliance in which we can make a statement or a credo of academic freedom that could be used as a standard against which faculty members' freedom and students' freedom could be measured on any university campus. It was a direct result of the E.A. Ross case that this occurred. And in 1915, the American Association of University Professors published its famous statement of academic freedom and tenure, and E.A. Ross was in the middle of this. Essentially, the principles are these, that a professor in a university has the right, and in fact, as we will explore in a moment, the duty to be intellectually honest and to pursue truth, to pursue his or her research in the directions which their professional expertise would dictate, and that neither the university or forces outside the university should interfere with that right and duty. At the same time, obligations come along with academic freedom, and the professor's duty as well is to publish accurately and courageously whatever it is the research turns up, whether it be faith-promoting or not, whether it be potentially damaging to interest in the society or not. But the professor's duty in relationship to this right is to be honest, impeccably honest, in reporting whatever is found and whatever he or she concludes. Second principle of academic freedom is that a professor is free to teach in the classroom within his or her area of expertise, whatever it is they feel is appropriate. In other words, no one should interfere with my or any other professor's choice of textbooks, choice of ideas, choice of whatever is taught there. At the same time, I have a duty to avoid indoctrinating students, forcing them, in other words, infringing on their academic freedom, to parrot what I believe or what I conclude about the material. My responsibility and my right is to teach what materials I feel are appropriate to the task and purpose of the course. The student's right in freedom is not necessarily to accept what it is I propose, the ideas that may be my most cherished ones that I carry forth in the classroom and the like. So in the classroom, you're free to teach what you think is appropriate within your area of expertise. Now, as professor of educational and higher education, I have no right to propound my favorite theory about vitamin C, as Linus Pauling does. That's outside my area of expertise, and unless I could make some direct link between vitamin C and learning capacity and make it plausible, that's just off limits for me, as are anything beyond the areas in which we're teaching. But in our areas of expertise, the idea is that's where this academic freedom pertains most directly. Third, academic freedom means that we have a right, like any other citizen, to express our views on any darn thing we wish. So here, not covering myself as a professor at the University of Utah, but as a citizen, I can say anything I want about vitamin C or anything else I wish to expound on. The responsibility that comes with this third element of academic freedom is that I can't use the cloak of the university to lend credence to what I'm saying unless it's within my area of expertise. So if I want to talk about vitamin C and write a letter to the governor or the legislature or anyone else saying this needs to be included in the diet or the drinking water or whatever, it would be completely inappropriate for me to sign this professor so-and-so and use the university letterhead. It's entirely appropriate for me or you or anyone else to harangue anyone who wish along that line. That's a civil right, not an academic right. So we have no right. In fact, we have an obligation not to use our universities as a means of lending credibility to what we say outside our own areas. Well, the E.A. Ross case, in fact, is quite instructive with regard to the current controversy at BYU, in that the Stanford Board of Trustees could have said to E.A. Ross, you're free to investigate the labor practices of anybody else in the world, just don't investigate the labor practices of Leland Stanford in the Central Pacific Railroad. And the point that was made there is that just as you can't be half pregnant, you can't be half free. And the AAUP has always taken a strong position that the university cannot draw limits or place certain areas of investigation outside the purview of academic freedom, that you either have it or you don't. And that is the nub of the controversy. As Fred has said, academic freedom has always been a controversial matter. It's always been a matter of tension, and I think it always will be. But if there is one value that is central to a university, it's academic freedom. In fact, I might say that academic freedom is to a university what God is to a church. We have churches that don't worship God, but we think of them as rather curious entities. And likewise, universities that don't fully honor the principles of academic freedom are viewed as rather odd entities. And in fact, though it may pinch not all of the faculty, but in fact a very few who, like E.A. Ross, choose to investigate something which is wished to be off limits by the Board of Trustees, you're just not free and you're just not wholly in the category of a university, in my view, unless you accept that principle and honor it fully. And I think that's what the conflict at BYU at this point is all about. I look forward to the conversation. Thanks.
I find myself in a rather curious position, being the only representative of BYU and also one of the actors in the current controversy on academic freedom. In needing to express multiple voices, many different voices, to try to bring them into balance. One difficulty that I face is that of being a scholar, in other words, trying to present a balanced, fair presentation of an event, as I understand it, its social or personal individual causes, and my need as a political actor to justify my case or my position in the current struggle and crisis. I'm going to try to attack sort of a delicate course between each extreme. This has been a hot year at BYU. It's been a hot year for those of us who've been involved in the issue of academic freedom since the Sunstone Symposium statement was made last August, I believe. It was the 1st of September. I can't remember the exact date. Since that statement was made, it's been a hot year. And more and more professors have been getting involved in questions of academic freedom. No matter how you cut it, this issue is one that divides us along things that are very central to our being. It splits us in terms of things that we consider very crucial to ourselves as members of the church, our faith in the brethren, our testimony, our commitment and obedience. It also challenges us along lines of our professional responsibility, along lines of our commitment to our colleagues, along lines of our commitment to the central value of education, which has been adequately expressed as being academic freedom. Yes, academic freedom has been a problem at most universities. I taught for 2 years at Washington University in St. Louis. During my stay there, I was in the anthropology department, but we were right next door to the sociology department. During my stay there, the sociology department was canceled. It was done away with. Can you imagine a major university without a sociology department? Washington University decided it didn't need one. The politics of it are very dense. It was done very carefully. The reasoning was that of fiscal management. They couldn't afford to have a sociology department of first rank, so it's better not to have one at all. Better to put their resources elsewhere. I mention this because I think we need to situate the argument of academic freedom in a larger context. I'm not a scholar who studies universities, per se, nor am I a scholar of education. I'm simply an anthropologist who works among peasants in Bolivia. But I'll talk about peasants in the academic environment or something. My sense is that universities in the United States are in a process of change, in a process of transformation. I'm sure that all of you have heard about the debates of multiculturalism and the debate over core curriculum. Now, this is a debate that's very easily misunderstood. We can get caught up in the ideological niceties, which are fun to debate. But I have to say, as an anthropologist, I look at the structural questions laying behind it. And what I see is a university that is having to fill new needs in society, that's being caught between the old ideas of liberal arts, of a humanistic education, or a university that's simply to fulfill a technical requirement, namely to train people to fill jobs. Is a university a factory? Or is a university a builder of character? Those two ideas are in some ways mutually contradictory. The debate runs in ways that are strange. For example, one sees it very clearly in the way funding is apportioned in universities. Also at Washington University, funding was split. No longer was there the consensus of that university that a university should be funded equally, more or less. In other words, that the funds should be pooled and then apportioned out in a reasonable fashion to all the departments of the university. Washington University was separate, and I believe that each college was responsible for its own funding. So we had the oddity that people in the English department, the history department, humanities in other words, had a hard time getting pieces of paper. They had torn chairs, old desks, a computer, heaven forbid. Well, the business school was very lavishly apportioned, very wealthy. Salaries were equally divided in terms of those who were in English and the humanities, as opposed to those who were in the more technical areas of the university. This led to a certain invidiousness, but underneath it, I think you can see what I'm talking about the restructuring of the university. We face a question here in our society about what a university is for, what role it is to fill in our society. Is it to simply be a factory producing laborers to fit into niches? If that is the case, then it simply inculcates, it indoctrinates knowledge that's a given commodity to teach people to move the right buttons and levers. Or is it the kind of thing that produces critical thought, in which case the classical humanistic education is necessary? I feel I need to lay that background because it's something we often forget. Now, the case of BYU, there's another background that I think we need to know. President Rex Lee of the university gave a speech to each of the colleges in winter semester. In it, he pointed out that BYU is one of the few remaining religiously sponsored universities in the United States. Religious universities are on a decline. BYU has been immensely successful. But two people like President Lee, two people in the Board of Trustees, there seems to be a conflict between BYU as a religious university, which in part is to help strengthen and support testimonies of young Latter-day Saints, and BYU, as someone called it, a Trojan horse of secularism. Which is the university to be? As a Trojan horse of secularism, it can be seen as something that is there to, in a sense, destroy the very base of our religious ideas. And there are people who hold to this idea and see BYU as a very dangerous element, a dangerous force. As a Trojan horse of secularism, it is the vanguard, the shock troops that would change BYU, that would transform, challenge Latter-day Saint culture and Latter-day Saint character in the United States. Evidently, I judge from the statement and from President Lee's speech to the faculty, people feel that they're on the cutting edge protecting our right as Latter-day Saints to be Latter-day Saints in this very diverse culture of the United States. In a culture in which there's constant legal pressures in favor of certain organization of knowledge or certain organizations of institution or enabling certain categories of people to have more access than other people. And as such, they would like to protect what they see as central, namely the religious heritage. I have to agree with them to a large extent. I think there is something beautiful and precious in our Mormon background and our Mormon heritage. I think it would be a shame to lose that. It would be an absolute shame. But I fear that this controversy on academic freedom can be the very thing that could damage the possibility of maintaining our Mormonism as I love it. Let me make myself clear. I haven't looked at the document for 2 months. I've been out of the country, and so I just got in last night, didn't have a chance to get the document. So I'm going to be talking somewhat off the top of my head. But as I recall, the document seems to read that faculty members are employees rather than being a collective of scholars. Now, in this notion of employees, one sees a corporate model, a model of business. I, as an employee of a business, would not be allowed to speak to what my bosses thought appropriate. My rights as an employee would be limited. Information can be seen as proprietary. I don't subscribe to that model of a university. Nor, and I have to make this clear, do I subscribe to that model of a church, of a body of believers and faithful. I think that that's a wrong model to apply, simply because it limits our freedom as believers to exercise our own right of inquiry, of faith, of prayer, of thought, and of discussion. not to mention the limitations of academic freedom. I think a church, as well as a university, is a collective, a gathering of members who come together because they share common things, who come together in a journey, if you will, a struggle, a quest. Call it the plan of salvation or call it the quest for knowledge. There's some interesting harmonies there between the Mormon and the scientific quest. Anyway, there's a contrasting model, that of business, the corporate empire. The document tends to state that we're employees. I'm not merely an employee of a university. As an employee, I could never fulfill my function as a scholar nor as a teacher in the sense of stimulating free inquiry. But I could if the model of the university is that of a technical school that is simply to produce a product of people who are able to manipulate the appropriate levers and buttons. I mentioned the theological danger of this model. Freedom of inquiry, freedom of thought, freedom to doubt, to question, is absolutely required for faith. The problem is that when a church such as our own is in struggle or faces itself threatened by the outside world, that it'll want to build boundaries around itself, that it'll want to codify, to do away with the dangerous ones within as well as without, as a type of social control. The problem is that when things become overly rigidified, when they become codified, when those boundaries become firmed, when a situation like that of the Holy Inquisition develops, if Torquemadas ever arise within us, then we will have denied the very possibility of there being a true gospel of Jesus Christ. But yet there's a tension, because we need a central anchor. We need a central point. This is one of the problems of the document. BYU has the legitimate right to place limits on academic freedom as a religious university. But those have to be stipulated before a faculty member is hired, to that faculty member in person. They have to be codified, be made part of university procedure. This document on academic freedom is a careful attempt, a well-thought-out and well-reasoned attempt, which I disagree with, but I have to recognize its goodness, a well-thought-out attempt to create such a structure. The problem is, what do you define as the limit? The attempt is to define the limit in terms of Mormon dogma. What is Mormon doctrine? Do any of us know? Really? Do any of us agree? Really? Other than on some very general points? The problem is that because the statement now is probably going to become legal fact at BYU, that faculty members who contradict or challenge church doctrine can be held accountable, not just in their professional lives, but even in their personal lives. Another point is that BYU faculty have to sustain the brethren in the church. In the abstract, I think most of us faculty members at BYU would agree with those points. In the specific details in which they're going to function, as a matter of procedure, as law, I think there's a problem. And I think I'm not the only one. Many faculty think there is a problem in it. Many faculty who are rather scared and horrified of what these might actually mean in practice. The problem is that we don't know what it means in practice. There are many other things I could say. I've just gotten the 1 minute note, so... As I said, this has been a hard year at BYU. I have to say one thing that the note does not take into account, the letter does not take into account, and I think it's one of the hardest things for us to take into account, is that the problem with academic freedom at BYU is not professors who run around doing weird things or damaging faith and testimony. Rather, the problem is the capricious use of power on the part of people like the Board of Trustees. Let me make clear, by even stating that, I run the risk under the new document of being dismissed from BYU. But I think that it has to be noticed that it's the capricious use of power in mobilizing or maintaining or protecting whatever the central values that I see as the central problem. How do we solve this? How do we stop it? I don't know. I know that right now that the problem is intense. You all have probably heard the rumor that Bruce Hafen denied, and I've also heard that the denial was not was very carefully expressed, let me say that. About a letter at BYU requesting an investigation into 6 faculty members. To find grounds, personal or religious, academic or religious, by which they might be dismissed. This is an interesting attempt to find reasons of bureaucratic efficiency to dismiss people who are thorns. Not to address the ideas squarely and frontally, but instead to find bureaucratic technical means by which the irritant might be removed. I see that as a problem, as a very difficult problem that we're going to be facing in the fall at BYU. And I would hope that as we face this problem, those of us at BYU, as well as those of us in the broader Mormon community, that we remember that the people on both sides of the issue are good people, that they're people who are faithful, who care deeply about our community, and that we can maintain at least the hope and the possibility of rebuilding community and unity once this conflict of two different contrasting values in our own thought, in our own culture, is through. Thank you.
I'd like to state at the outset that my understanding about this issue at BYU about the academic freedom statement or draft statement and the process going on there surrounding that is information that is mostly not firsthand. I am not an insider to BYU. All I know really is what I read from a copy of the draft statement, which Alan faxed to me. So I have read that carefully, I think. And in the very latest issue of Sunstone, there is some coverage of that document and some of the controversy surrounding it. I've read that. I've talked to a number of good friends and colleagues that I have on the faculty, but I cannot speak to this issue as a real insider, certainly not with the personal stake that someone like Dave Knowlton has. And so I want that to be understood. At the same time, I have to say that as an LDS academic, I care a great deal about BYU and what happens there. For many years, I have watched the development of that university. Indeed, some 25 years or so ago, I was invited for two or three years running to negotiate for a faculty position there. I'm quite willing to say I was never tempted, even a tiny little bit, to proceed with the negotiations, not because I didn't have high regard for the university and its potential, but because I could see, even from what I already knew, that I would be very soon getting in a lot of trouble there. And to some extent from my behavior, but mostly from my writing and from the kinds of church-related issues I was prepared to write about. Indeed, the race issue, as you'll all remember, was a big thing then. And there were an awful lot of people who were not academics that didn't want to anything said about it. I couldn't, I think, have published anything about that and kept a job at that time at that university. So I kind of knew that to some extent on good grounds and to some extent more intuitively. But still, I care a lot about the university and have watched with admiration over the last 20 years or so as that university has become a very strong and major university, whether public or private. I think that in many disciplines, that university, including my own discipline, that university has the strongest departments in the entire region. I think it has the strongest, many of its departments are the strongest, certainly that are to be found between Arizona and Washington, certainly in a region of some six or eight states around Utah. Many of the disciplines at BYU would have to be rated as among the top two or three in their strength and their resources. I have a lot of admiration for my colleagues in sociology and related disciplines particularly, who have gone there and built and added so much strength and talent to both the graduate and undergraduate levels of development there. So I do care. I have worried, however, as I watched that development, about how long it would take before, as you might say, the other shoe dropped. Of course, shoes have been dropping there periodically for some decades, as we all know. And the university has often thought of itself or used as a model Harvard, the one here sometimes that BYU aspires to be the Harvard of the West. My concern is that if it can't be the Harvard of the West, at least it not become the Oral Roberts University of the West. I believe that we that it's important to retain the broader context that Dave alluded to, however, in his comments. BYU is by no means the only university in the country undergoing a struggle over orthodoxy and how orthodoxy is to be defined and imposed. Certainly, the reconsideration now underway at many public universities about the fundamental curriculum and what part is to be played by traditional Western civilization studies as opposed to the new kinds of ethnic studies. That is very much an argument over what orthodoxy shall prevail in the curriculum. There is also a struggle over orthodoxy in opinion and speech outside of the classroom on the part of both the faculty and the students. We've all heard the argument over what's politically correct. And maybe that phrase is hackneyed in some ways and misleading, but yet there certainly are universities that have attempted, and to some extent have succeeded, at least at the documentary level, in putting in place rules against expressing certain kinds of animosity or negative comments about certain protected categories of people. Especially attempts have been made to define the intent of the speaker. When somebody, for example, makes a derogatory comment, or even a comment that is not derogatory toward a person, but a comment derogatory or negative toward a category, what is that person's intent? Was he motivated by hate? And we have a new category developing of so-called hate crimes that are being defined and administered even at the at governmental levels. Was a speaker, student or faculty, in an open forum or in a classroom, motivated by hate when he or she said this or that about black people, about homosexual people, or whatever the category is? You can get in trouble for saying things at a lot of places besides BYU, and I think it's important to keep that larger framework. I think another parallel to the secular universities that we have to keep in mind here is the what might be called the grassroots environment within which academics operate. It's as true among Mormons, maybe more so, I don't know, but it is as true among Mormons as it is among Americans generally, that hardly anybody at the grassroots thinks that professors are normal people. And there's an enormous amount of suspicion about what happens when you turn academics loose on students. Whenever there's a controversy on a public campus, and I'm up at Washington State in Eastern Washington, which is a rural setting, the other Cougars, I have to always explain, When up there, we're surrounded by people who are very conservative in social and political matters. And they simply have no sympathy whatever for professors that teach things that might be subversive to their children. And when an academic freedom controversy of any kind breaks out at a school like that, why, the public, the taxpayers that are supporting the school, the legislators that they send to the state capitol, all say, almost unanimously, well, why is he talking about stuff like that? Who needs to know that? See, you don't just hear this at BYU. The issues might be a little different. But we need to understand that we operate in a context, a broader context, in which Every academic institution runs the risk of having some kind of orthodoxy or another imposed on it, or that there is an attempt to impose it. That nearly all universities operate in a framework in which there is little or no grassroots support for the whole idea of academic freedom. Now, there hasn't really been very much said about the contents of this draft statement, and I will not, you'll be relieved to know, read it to you or even summarize it. But I think you should know that it is presented in basically two parts. Running through both parts is a bifurcation or division between academic freedom for institutions like BYU and academic freedom for individuals. The individual versus institutional kind of academic freedom is a tension that runs through the entire document. And as Dave indicated, the board, administration, and I'm sure the faculty, by and large at BYU, recognize the importance of trying to maintain the uniqueness of a place like BYU, whether it's based on religious ideals or any other kind. And so certainly, as the argument goes, a university like BYU has the right in this great pluralism of academic institutions in the United States to be unique and different and peculiar. And it shouldn't be forced to adopt the same, exactly the same definitions of academic freedom that other institutions might adopt. But intention against that, of course, is the individual academic freedom of faculty and students. Now, as you read what that document says about those two kinds of academic freedom, my own reaction is that it's basically quite unexceptionable at the abstract level. In fact, in places it verges on platitude. Maybe it all needs to be said, but I didn't find very much to object to in the statement until we got toward the end of it, in part two, which dealt with kind of the operational aspect, the implementation of these ideals and platitudes. And that gives a lot of grounds, it seems to me, for concern. We're told, for example, at the individual level, that what might constitute grounds for a discipline against individual faculty, or what might constitute the limits beyond which they cannot go in exercising their academic freedom, are contradicting or opposing fundamental doctrines or policies of the church, attacking or deriding church leaders. Now, almost every one of those terms is fraught with definitional ambiguity, as a couple of my predecessors here have mentioned. It's not just the question of what constitutes contradicting or opposing church doctrine, but it's the question of what in the world is church doctrine. Before you get into what constitutes opposing it. If one general authority thinks that there are seven deadly heresies, how many other deadly heresies might there be? And who says what a heresy is, especially if one contemporary apostle's heresy is a truth to, say, Brigham Young? What constitutes attacking or deriding church leaders? First of all, what church leaders are we talking about? Are we talking only about general authorities? Are we talking about your local bishop? Are we talking about some high priest group leader that's done or said something stupid? Who is a church leader here for these purposes? What constitutes attacking that leader? These are, again, all problems that are potentially very worrisome to anybody, I think, who reads this document. So what we get down to is what we really haven't seen yet, and that I didn't really know was in the offing, but Dave mentioned that there's a second document coming out that's supposed to talk about implementation of this. Well, that's going to be the crucial thing, is the question of implementation. What mechanisms are going to be in place for adjudicating these cases? What part will any faculty committee play in recommending or advising administration on some of these issues? Will a faculty adjudicatory body of some kind have anything to say about this? Will a case go first to a body of faculty peers of an accused academic so that they can make a recommendation then on up? Or will this go immediately to an administrative body for consideration? And what enforcement is going to be required in some of the other aspects of this document that were kind of left at the platitudinous level but not otherwise taken up? In a couple of different places, for example, this document defines the environment at BYU as one in which there is charity all around for opposing points of view. Well, when one faculty member in one department charges another faculty member in another department with being an apostate or not really having a testimony, something he wrote in church history, is that an uncharitable statement? If so, what's going to be done about that? Well, there are a lot of interesting potential implications, and I'm down to less than a minute, so I'll beg Alan's indulgence for maybe 2 minutes instead of one, I promise. One of the interesting things that that might issue from this controversy and from whatever the final version is of this statement that's adopted is maybe something quite unintended. It is entirely possible in my mind that once a statement of this kind is adopted, it might have the unintended consequence of imposing almost as much constraint on the board and administration as it imposes on the faculty. If there is an actual document somewhere defining the limits of academic freedom, then that document will as much prevent board and administration from going over the bounds from the one direction as it will faculty from the other. One of the things that could happen out of this such a statement is that it would force the board to take ultimate and public responsibility for disciplining or firing a faculty member rather than having it done under the table, around the corner, through the local priesthood leaders, or in some of the other circuitous ways that this discipline has been exercised so far. I think that anything that forces the exercise of unrighteous dominion to be public is all to the good, and that could be one implication of this document. On the other hand, another implication could be that if the faculty is disciplined regularly, or even if there are only one or two celebrated cases, what we are going to see at BYU is a more and more selective recruitment of both faculty and students. The selection of students is already very selective. We will see a more and more selective recruitment of faculty members, such that only the most timid and the least adventurous people will be willing to come to that institution, and that would be a great shame. That is definitely a possible outcome of this, especially, again, if we ask the question at the operational level. When we get down, aside from disciplining mavericks, we get down to the question of new hiring. How is that going to be done? Will some new tests be imposed in the kinds of interviews that are conducted and the questions that are asked? Will some new tests be imposed that will prevent future difficulties over academic freedom by simply not hiring people in the first place who might represent a straining of the boundaries? The bottom line, ladies and gentlemen, is that however it turns out, the general authorities of the church have the power to decide how this is going to turn out. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. That's the bottom line. They ultimately have the power to decide whether the university is going to move, continue to move, as I think it has, more and more in the direction of the model of Harvard, or whether it's going to move more and more in the direction of Oral Roberts University. I think they have the power to decide, and they will make that decision on their own assessment of the cost benefit, their own cost benefit analysis or their own risk benefit analysis. And we can't always be sure what thinking will go into that. But in my experience, to end on a happy note, I have had as much grounds to be optimistic about the ultimate collective wisdom of the general authorities and their ultimate pragmatism than I have to be pessimistic. And so I am hoping that when all is said and done, and more than three or four of the most outspoken general authorities are in a position to make the final decision about the future, that it might not look so bleak as it seems to at the moment. Thank you.
I thank all of you for those statements. I think we've well defined the dimensions of the problem, and perhaps we could take the balance of the time to try to focus in on possible solutions or answers. I'd like to take the prerogative of posing a couple of questions and still hope to leave some time for you. The first one is long, and I'll read it, and I'll preface it by saying that my understanding is that the National Accreditation Board does allow limitation of academic freedom as a policy of universities, particularly religious universities, but that is allowed provided there is a written statement of justification that is available to be evaluated by the board and by persons, and I think faculty and students even. I think that the Y was essentially required to prepare the statement in response to that requirement. My question is, and it's long, the draft statement puts an unusual twist on the idea of academic freedom by maintaining that the virtue of BYU is that students are free to believe the revealed truths of God rather than the less reliable secular truths of man. This obvious difficulty comes when the two sets of truths are in conflict. For example, science gives us a different picture of the age of humankind than the church view. The various critical methods of scriptural analysis point to the Book of Mormon as a 19th century product rather than an ancient creation in opposition to the church's view. Capitalism is tied to manifest destiny and American economic and governmental systems as divinely inspired, whereas secular political scientists would give natural explanations for political systems and not favor anyone as inherently superior. These conflicts are not easily reconciled. The question is then, with such a policy or such a statement on academic freedom, how much control can a university exercise before it ceases to function in the basic role as a university, and where do we draw the line in control? So we're asking questions about the effect of the statement on the faculty, on the students, and even supporters of the university. I'd like to ask each panelist that would like to respond to take maybe 2 minutes and try to focus in on the solution side of the question.
Well, I think I'd like to say something briefly. That's really quite a complex question. Alan is right. BYU, from what my understanding, BYU had to respond to the accreditation board's concern about academic freedom at BYU. I've heard, I don't know this for a fact, that there have been problems over BYU's ongoing accreditation because of previous limitations on academic freedom that have occurred there, and indeed the lack of a policy. The problem is once a policy is defined, that policy then becomes law. Yes, to answer part of Armin's question, as I understand it, the concerns will be addressed by faculty committees. And in the faculty committee, there's a chance to debate or to discuss an issue that recognizes the norms and values of faculty procedure or academic life, as well as the concerns of the brethren. I also think Armand has put his finger really thoroughly on the problem. The problem is one of politics. The problem is one of who decides which powers actually get to decide what is the content or what is the basis of academic freedom. When Ellen asks what should be the boundaries or how do we solve questions of faith, when they come into conflict, that's not just a question of academic freedom. That's a question for me every time I go to priesthood meeting or Sunday school. How do I deal with the fact? I was at a lovely priesthood meeting in Sunday school, in Bolivia last week. And basically I bit my tongue. The teacher was reading his manual and was wrenching scriptures right and left and making them say things they didn't say. And all I had to do was read the preceding scriptures and knew they didn't say anything that he wanted them to say. But if I had said anything in that class, I would have been challenging the doctrinal foundation. And actually it was a bishop teaching the class. I would have been challenging it, ostensibly the right of the bishop or his correctness as a leader. In other words, we're moving through terrain that's very difficult because it brings into question sacred issues. It brings into question issues of power and control over the church, not just issues of faith and debate or faith and answers to gospel questions. Personally, I think that the tension is necessary between faith and science, between faith and empirical learning, empirical reasoning, or even philosophical reasoning. It's out of the tension that we grow. Personally, I cannot imagine a faith where everything is cut and dried, where we open up a manual and that says everything there is. I think the 13th article of faith is the one that we have to hang, because there are many virtuous and lovely things in stuff that people around here may not like Marxism or like feminism or like higher criticism or whatever. Yes, they raise conflicts and difficulties for us. But they've done that for religious people from the beginning of time. They also do that for any ideology, for any political system, for any body of thought. If nothing else, they force us to think, to reconceive our categories, and to develop greater faith. Now, as far as the solution to the problem goes, I think Armin put his finger on it. Ultimately, this is out of our hands. The politics of producing the statement is the statement had to respond to the needs of the Board of Trustees and to maintaining their control, their power over the university, because they see themselves as the cutting edge protecting the body of Mormonism from the onslaught of secularism, with those of us professors being somewhat shock troops of secularism. Kind of defies reason to me, but there's a political question of how the policy is going to be implemented, but there's also a cultural question, and that cultural question, I think, gets right to the root of what Alan's asking. Do we as Latter-day Saints have a culture that really favors critical inquiry? Do we as Latter-day Saints really value the person who disagrees with us? Can we talk honestly and openly about issues of concern without bringing up final concerns like salvation or righteousness or things like that? Can we do that? Unfortunately, I have to say that my experience as a professor for 2 years at BYU is that many students can't. And that many of my peers as faculty have trouble when issues arise that cut close to the core of their faith. Yet I think that's necessary for us to grow as persons and as a people, to develop a culture that encourages discussion, critical inquiry, such that I could stand here and discuss aspects of Elder Packer's recent talk in a general conference, a man I find fascinating, I have to admit that. But this has some flaws of empirical reasoning. He makes some misstatements of facts. Yet as a BYU professor or as a Latter-day Saint, to even mention that suggests to many people that I'm criticizing the brethren, that I'm criticizing the Lord's anointed, and therefore I must be an apostate. Unless we can deconstruct or collapse those polar opposites in our culture, I don't see a hope for really building academic freedom. And I say that because right now things are very conflictive. Maybe I'm caught in the middle of it. But I would hope it happens. I would really hope it happens.
The kind of issues that you describe, Alan, in your question, it seems to me, are ones that must remain open to debate. In any educational institution, be it the university or otherwise. The question is the direction of the movement at BYU. I've talked with a number of faculty friends down there in the last week or two about this in preparation for the panel. And I think all but one said this statement gives us more protection, though it's not perfect, and it does proscribe our academic freedom more than we would like. It actually gives us more freedom than we've enjoyed in the past. So for whatever it's worth, they find some solace in that regard.
I want to turn my main thought at this point, however, to a second element of Alan's question and an issue that a couple of the other panelists have mentioned as well. If ultimately the power to make decisions about these things rests with the Board of Trustees at BYU, we need to remind ourselves that it is more the Oral Roberts tradition than it is the not just the Harvard tradition, but the Notre Dame or the Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C. tradition for the appointment of trustees. That is, other significant church-supported universities in this nation have moved away from having church leaders be the trustees of the institution and have appointed members of the faith who have distinguished themselves in various walks of life to the boards of trustees. And it seems to me the real progress in terms of the church and BYU will come when the Quorum of the Twelve decide that it is not they who should be the Board of Trustees there, but in fact we should turn to other distinguished Mormons from many walks of life, as well as the sprinkling of other people outside the church, to be the ultimate authorities in orchestrating the affairs of the Brigham Young University.
With respect to the kind of dichotomy that Alan was referring to in each of those issues between the traditional church interpretation and the secular interpretations, again, in principle, and I should be not, there should not be a problem here. Seems to me that any professor or teacher who is worth his, her salt or whatever they get paid in these days has the obligation and ideally the ability to explain clearly to the students that these are two different ways of understanding the understanding nature, understanding reality, that the consensus of church teaching these days seems to be this, the consensus of scientific teaching, on the other hand, tends to be this, that it is possible to reconcile these two things at this level. It's not possible to reconcile them at this level. There is, in every explanation for reality, there is an element of faith. It's very clear on the religious side where the faith comes from. It's not always so clear, but should be made more clear on the secular side, that much of what passes for science is the collective and negotiated definitions of reality that have come down through generations of time to the present, that not everything that is laid down as scientific theory should be understood as verified for time and all eternity, any more than we have seen an unchanging history of doctrine in the LDS Church or any other. And I submit that any teacher who does not do that is not being fair to the students. And I don't think it matters whether one's teaching in a church school or not. When one knows about these alternative ways of understanding the universe, one has the obligation to make sure that is imparted to students and that they get to talk about it and that they know that at some levels there are some issues that can't be resolved and have to be accepted on faith if you're going to accept them. And at other levels, maybe you can make reconciliations. And I submit that to the extent that teachers at a place like BYU are prevented from doing that, the church runs a big risk that sooner or later the students are going to find out that they've been through an incubator and not through an institution of higher learning, and that's when they're going to lose their testimonies, not through something some professor said at the classroom.
In the 10 minutes or so we have left, I'd like to take questions from the audience. Would you please stand, state your question loudly so we can get it on tape, and if you feel like it, address it to a particular panelist. Thank you.
I guess I have to answer that, and the problem is that I'm out of my depth. I'm not. I've only been at BYU 2 years, and I don't have tenure. Probably never will, but I also don't proclaim to have any deep understanding of the manual or handbook of instructions at BYU. So I can only speak to sort of the common culture as it's been explained to me and as it certainly was explained to me in the hiring process. The word tenure is in common usage at BYU. I think the official word is continuing status. Basically, it gives someone a certain amount of protection. The contract is renewed ongoingly. However, as I understand it, faculty members can still be removed for cause. And the cause can be things like not being a good church member. That's already been practiced at BYU off and on. I don't know all the causes. I would have to have Rexley himself stand here to tell us, or Bruce Hafen or somebody. But let me point out also that at other universities, there are grounds for removal by which tenured faculty members can be removed. Tenure is important in the kind of protection it gives a faculty member. The untenured faculty member is in a probationary status. In my case, it's kind of weird to be a 37-year-old adolescent, but that's the way academia works. You don't get to be an adult until you're old and gray and stooped, unfortunately. Foot in mouth. Anyway, what I'm saying is there every university has grounds for removal. At BYU, there is a difficult question, though, because BYU would like to hire faculty members who are believing members of the church. But how do you know if somebody really believes? How will you ever know? They want to hire people who are righteous, but also how will you ever know somebody who's really righteous? Well, you put them through all the recommend procedure, have them interviewed, and then lo and behold, you find out that they do things that just kind of make it really hard for you. The problem is one of institutionalizing processes that really belong more to the domain of faith, to the domain of the final judgment, the last judgment, where the Lord, who's the knower of all things, can handle them. Putting them in a secular domain where you have to have physical indexes to define them. You were referring, I believe, to the case of David Wright. I wasn't here when that happened. I think most people have heard and people ought to know. David Wright's case has been a matter of concern among the faculty. And according to the document, a faculty member who expresses a belief contrary to church doctrine could possibly be disciplined. We can argue whether BYU has the right to do that or not. I think it's tricky. I think it's really tricky. But also to say that the university has no right to do it is even more tricky. The question is one of how we maintain a balance between the needs to maintain the gospel, to maintain the church, to what many people see as a hostile society, without at the same time destroying the very thing we want to maintain.
Let me follow up on that comment there, because I think there is a real need for that balance and for students to realize that it's not either or. And it's the either or thinking that really creates real problems at a university if it becomes dominant. Bertrand Russell, in his History of Western Civilization, makes this point. In studying a philosopher, the right attitude is neither reverence nor contempt, but first a kind of hypothetical sympathy until it is possible to know what it feels like to believe in his theories, and only then a revival of the critical attitude. Contempt interferes with the first part of the process, and reverence with the second. And so you've got to... The real trick is reverence for the church and critical attitudes towards ideas. And that's an ongoing dilemma. And I don't think any statement can solve that except to give maximum freedom to the faculty when possible.